All right. I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:19 p.m. on Monday, March 2nd. Members present are Representatives McCarty, Schrage, Kosher, Fields, Representative Snyder is on Teams. Thank you so much to our secretary today, Leah Fraser, and our LAO moderator, Marissa Truitt. As a reminder, please announce yourself before speaking for House records and also those listening online. Take a moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't done so already. Today, we've got three items on our agenda. We're going to have an introductory hearing on HB 111, Dental Hygienist Advanced Practice Permit, an introductory hearing on Committee Bill HB 155, Employment Benefits During COVID-19. I'm going to recognize that Representative Kaufman has joined us. We're going to have a second hearing and final action on HB 117, extending the Board of Direct Entry Midwives, and we will also forward the names of committee of nominees, appointees to committees that we heard on Friday. And welcome, Representative Snyder. Are there any questions before we proceed? Representative Schrage? None? Okay. All right, so we're going to go a little bit out of order. We want to make sure that we have an opportunity to ask Chris Curtis, who is our legislative auditor, if anybody has any questions for her about the sunset audit associated with the extension of the Board of Direct Entry Midwives. That item is last on our agenda, but we wanted to make sure committee members had an opportunity to ask her any questions, if they have any, before she has to leave, I believe, at 3:30 p.m. So are there any questions for Ms. Curtis? All right. Looks like you're off the hook. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. All right, and then since I'm going to be introducing two bills today, I'm going to take a brief at ease and hand the gavel over to Co-Chair Fields.
House Labor and Commerce. Up now, House Bill 111, Dental Hygienist Advanced Practice Permit. Representative Sponholz and her staff will be presenting. This is the first hearing of the bill in Labor and Commerce. Representative Sponholz.
All right. Thanks very much for hearing HB 111 today, creating an advanced practice permit for dental hygienists. So in the state of Alaska, currently, dental hygienists practice under the supervision of a dentist. HB 111 creates an advanced practice permit, which would allow an experienced licensed dental hygienist to provide preventive oral care to underserved populations at senior centers, healthcare facilities, daycare, schools, and for Alaskans that are eligible for public assistance, are homebound, or who live in an underserved community. Oral health plays a really crucial role in supporting overall health and well-being of Alaskans. Poor oral health contributes to the following issues. 62% of Alaska's elementary children have tooth decay. Many low-income individuals and families in Alaska don't regularly seek dental care because of cost, apprehension for dental care, access, and trouble finding a health care provider, as is referenced in Alaska's Oral Health and Well-Being report. Bad oral health is linked to cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, osteoporosis, as well as poor nutrition and other serious health issues. HB 111 aims to increase access to oral health care to underserved populations, specifically children, seniors, and individuals with disabilities. HB 111 creates an advanced practice permit for dental hygienists similar to one that is used by nurse practitioners, sort of a hybrid between what nurse practitioners have to practice independently and physician's assistants. Currently, dental hygienists can practice in a dental office or practice semi-independently if they have a collaborative agreement similar to what physician's assistants. HB 111 creates an advanced practice permit which will allow dental hygienists to care for underserved populations at senior centers, healthcare facilities, daycare, schools, and others that are underserved. The permit will be available to dental hygienists who have a minimum of 4,000 hours of clinical experience and who are approved by the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners. The bill lays out specific services that would be allowed by the permit and specific populations that would be served. This list has been developed in consultation with the Alaska Dental Society, the Board of Dental Examiners, and the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association. Advanced practice permit holders will have to maintain malpractice insurance, provide written notice of their service limitations, and make a referral to a dentist nearby if dental treatment is needed. This will allow dental hygienists to practice to the full scope of their training, credentials, and professional experience. And Alaska wouldn't be the first state to make these changes. Dental hygienists are able to practice under advanced practice permits or similar permits in six other states, including Colorado, Washington, Montana, Maine, Connecticut, and California. And 40 other states are considered direct access states, meaning that dental hygienists can initiate treatment based on their assessment of a patient's needs without prior authorization or presence of a dentist. I will note that we've already made some important changes to the bill at the recommendation of the Board of Dental Examiners and the Alaska Dental Society, including requiring permit holders to maintain patient records for at least 7 years, making sure that the Board of Dental Examiners has separately certified a dental hygienist to administer local anesthesia, and to empower the Department of Health and Social Services to make regulations related to this bill. So my first Alaskans fellow, Buckuck Burner, is going to do a presentation that includes a brief sectional analysis.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz. Good afternoon. My name is Buckuck Sophie Burner, and I am staff to Representative Sponholz. And I would like to go over the PowerPoint with you. I'm going to start with slide 2. All right, to kind of recap on what Representative Sponholz had said, 62% of Alaskan elementary students have a qualify for high tooth decay rates. Furthermore, 43% of low-income Alaskans have difficulties or have claimed to have difficulties biting and chewing. Overall, oral pain is an issue for young people and low-income individuals across America, and a major cause for these statistics is low-income families struggle with oral health care due to, as previously mentioned, cost, access, or trouble finding a provider. Moving on to slide 3, the outcome is that Alaska's vulnerable populations are disproportionately impacted by dental diseases, such as untreated cavities and high rates of gum disease. The best way to address oral care is preventative care, and this is where dental hygienists are crucial. Working on the forefront of oral care, dental hygienists are critical in both applying and educating underserved populations on the importance of oral health and well-being. Increase in oral health care through advanced practice permits meets the needs for various groups. These groups include children who are reliant on their guardians who might not have ability to provide access, seniors and elderly living in long-term care homes whose mobility might be restricted by age or other factors, Alaskans with disabilities, regardless whether of mobility issues or sensory issues with clinical spaces, Alaskans in remote correctional facilities, and rural Alaska communities with populations too small to warrant having a local clinic. Moving on to slide 4, I would like to go over a brief sectional analysis with you. I would like to stay on slide 1, slide 4 while I go over this. If you would like, you can follow along in your sectional analysis provided. Starting with section 1 of HB 111, this amends Alaska Statute 08.32.110 to include allowing dental hygienists who have advanced practice permits issued by the Board of Dental Examiners to perform their duties as allowed by the permit. Moving on to section 2, under Alaska Statute 08.32.125, the new section creates the advanced practice permit and the following requirements. As previously mentioned, dental hygienists will have a minimum requirement of 4,000 documented hours of clinical experience to obtain an advanced practice permit and in order to perform the following services. This includes oral health education, general oral health cleaning, creating treatment plans, screenings, and taking radiographs and delegating to a dental assistant. Moving on to subsection B, permits a dental hygienist holding an advanced practice permit to provide services to the individual who are unable to receive dental treatment. These individuals can be impacted by age, infirmity, or disability. Furthermore, individuals in long-term care facilities or residential health facilities or in correctional facilities attending certain educational centers or resident in a community where there are shortages of dental health professionals all qualify underneath this bill. Moving on to Section C allows dental hygienists holding advanced practice permits to provide the allowed services without supervision or prior examination from a licensed dentist to a patient. Continuing on to subsection D, this subsection requires a dental hygienist under the permit must maintain a professional liability insurance and that their patients or the legal guardian of the patients are to receive written notices and services provided, notice of the services provided, as well as the fact that the services provided will be limited to what is allowed by the permit. Additionally, if there's any further need for any form of oral care, the dental hygienist must provide a written recommendation for a licensed dentist and assist in receiving referral for the patient to a dentist. Moving on to subsection E, licensed dental hygienists with advanced practice permits may practice as independent contracts, as previously mentioned. Lastly, subsection F, advanced practice permits are valid until the license of the dental hygienist expires. At the time of renewal, the dental hygienist is able to renew both licenses at the same time. Moving on to section 3, section 3 addresses grounds for removals or loss of license. Statute 08.32.16 is amended to exempt dental hygienists with advanced practice permits from required supervision for clinical procedures. However, the license may be revoked in the case that a dental hygienist allows a dental assistant to perform a prohibited procedure, such as any form of fraudulent advertising or services of billing. Additionally, in the case that dental hygienists failed to maintain a record for the facility over the past 7 years, the license will also be removed. Moving on to Section 4. Section 4 allows a dental hygienist holding an advanced practice permit to delegate certain duties, such as taking radiographs or applying preventative agents to a dental assistant, as allowed by the board's regulations. Section 5 prohibits the insurance companies from discriminating against dental hygienists holding advanced practice permit from obtaining any form of insurance. This would refer back to the malpractice insurance earlier mentioned. Section 6 is amended to include dental hygienists to the list of optional services provided by the Department of Health and Social Services. Section 7 allows the following departments to adopt regulations necessary to implement changes in the bill. The following departments are the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, the Department of Health and Social Services, and the Board of Dental Examiners. The regulations will not take effect before the effective date of this bill. Section 8 states that what was just recently said, Section 7 on the department regulations takes effect immediately. Section 9 states the effective date for the Section 1 through 6 is July 1st, 2022. This now concludes the sectional analysis. Moving on to the final slide, the pre-former slide. This just kind of goes over dental health shortage areas, referring to geographic shortages, tribal shortage areas, state-provided shortages, and federally provided shortages. This concludes our presentation. We are more than happy to answer any of your questions. Thank you for your time.
And Mr. Chair, there are folks available to provide some invited testimony and answer questions include Lisa Bryant, who's the legislative co-chair of the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association, Lori Reitz with the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association, she's the vice president, Angie Stone with High Life Oral Health Alliance, and Ann Lynn, a former senator from Minnesota, both of whom worked on their state statutes that are similar to what's being proposed.
Thanks, Representative Sponholz. Let's do some questions first, and then we'll go to invited testimony. I have a question, and then we'll go to Representative McCarty. Section E on page 3, licensed dental hygienist may practice as an independent contractor. What does that mean?
Essentially, that means that a dental hygienist, if they have an advanced practice permit and a collaborative agreement with a dentist, that they would be able to have their own independent practice where they practice much like physician's assistants do in the state of Alaska. You might be familiar with many of the urgent cares, for example, in South Central are actually owned and operated by physician's assistants that operate with a direct care agreement in partnership with a doctor. It would be similar to that.
Yeah, I guess my only question, the term independent contractor usually has other connotations in terms of labor law, workers' comp, minimum wage, and I'm wondering, let's see, I guess I just want to make sure that we're not unintentionally excluding, like, from workers' comp coverage or other labor laws using that language, so maybe we could have Ledge Legal return and speak to that in the next meeting and make sure that, well, I mean, I almost wonder if it needs different terminology, just because independent contractor
typically
is considered not to be an employee.
Yeah, we'll follow up on that.
Okay. Had another question. So I saw some areas listed, and I see that basically pediatrics is an area recommended where these dental hygienists could practice. Do we have any data on accessibility for pediatric dentistry in Anchorage and how, if at all, this would address it? I mean, my sense is there are lots of pediatric dentists, so the supply is there in terms of the practitioners, but what are the barriers in terms of kids who don't actually have pediatric care? Is
so
that health insurance coverage? Is it something else?
The access, the populations that are being proposed to be served by the creation of this permit are those that are underserved. So underserved populations are often those that are low income and lack access to adequate health care that are provided services through, for example, federally qualified health centers in Anchorage, where you and I live, Mr. Co-Chair, that would be Anchorage Neighborhood Health. And so Anchorage Neighborhood Health could hire, you know, an advanced practice dental hygienist to provide the preventative screening and treatment that would be necessary for its underserved population, for example.
Okay. I think I'm going to go to Jesse Minkins to help answer this question, then we'll go to Representative McCarty's question. Ms. Minkins, my question basically is, what percentage of kids right now are not getting adequate dental care? And if this bill passed, how would you foresee care reaching those kids? Do you have any comment on that?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. And for the record, this is Jesse Minkins with the Alaska Primary Care Association. Mr. Chair, I do not have that figure at my fingertips to share with you today, but I'd be happy to share it in follow-up. But to what we heard from Representative Sponholz, in relation to the population that is served within the walls of federally qualified health centers, those facilities are mandated to provide the safety net care regardless of an individual's ability to pay. And in those FQHCs, yes, we do see pediatric care happening and low-income families relying on their health centers to provide that care. We see that this is an advantage and are in support of this bill. It is becoming a national best practice, and as I'll provide testimony later today, we see that this would be a huge positive impact to provide additional mid-level provider types to fill unmet need of oral health care in the Anchorage area and the state at large.
Okay. Representative McCarty.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, I have several questions.
Just proceed with a series.
Pardon?
Proceed with a series.
Okay, right. Thank you. So through the chair, first one on page 2, line 7, that the 4,000 documented hours of clinical experience, is that defined as what those actual experience hours are supposed to look like?
I think that question might be better answered by Lisa Bryant with the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association.
Ms. Bryant.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me on today. I can hear reverb with myself. I'm not sure why that is, but I'll try to work through that. The 4,000 hours of working time is approximately 2 to 3 years worth of working experience for a dental hygienist to practice. It is the same amount of time that is required to have a collaborative agreement in Alaska.
The follow-up to that is that I'm want to differentiate that.
You're a little closer to the microphone, Representative McCurdy.
All right, can you hear me now?
Yeah, there we go.
Thanks. I want to differentiate that the hours that are direct services with a patient compared to hours that might be doing clinical notes or reviewing charts or whatever it may be. Is that is there some differentiation there in the 4,000 hours?
There is no separation in hours in that, because any time we provide treatment to a patient, we're reviewing health histories, we're reviewing the radiographs, assessing patients' needs, and providing care all at the same time. Those are not separate hours.
And just the last follow-up with this question here, I have more, is what do we see in other states? Are they differentiating the hour that are attained from patient direct hours to clinical note hours?
No, sir, I have not seen anyone differentiate in between like administrative time versus clinical time.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Lori Wright, who's the Vice President of Alaska Dental Hygienists Association, might be appropriate to answer that question. She actually earned one of these permits in another state and could probably answer it a little more specificity.
Sure, go ahead, Ms. Reitz.
I didn't actually earn a permit in another state, just to clarify that. I've only practiced in Alaska, but I can tell you that I graduated from a bachelor's program in Oregon that trains hygienists to have an expanded practice dental hygiene license, which is very similar to this advanced practice permit. And in that, as long as you had training from an accredited program, then you could operate through that. So each state has different, I'm familiar with the Oregon one, and that does not require the 4,000 clinical hours. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Maybe Ms. Stone with my High Life Oral Health Alliance, who is also out of state, could address the question.
Sure. Ms. Stone, do you have an answer to Representative McCarty's question? Well, perhaps she can return to it in her invited testimony.
Okay.
Does that cover it, Ms. Representative McCarty?
It covers just that one piece there, if I could just add on to these.
Of course,
others.
Go ahead.
And one of the concerns or would like to see is make sure that a practitioner has actual experience with patients in their hours rather than padding it with just paperwork experience of hours and yet not having the experience with the patient.
Representative McCarty, the intention is that this is a form of licensure that would become available to somebody who had already become a dental hygienist in the state of Alaska and then practiced for 4,000 hours as a professional on top of that and then sought the licensure. So they would have, in fact, been practicing in the community for 4,000 hours before they were even eligible to apply, not kind of a paperwork sort of a position, but an actual practitioner of dental hygiene care.
Okay. So thank you. So that you're explaining that they've already been a practitioner, mm-hmm. a dental hygienist, mm-hmm. but not advanced. And to be advanced, they have to add another 4,000 hours on top of that.
Yes, sir.
All right. Very good. Page 4, line 2, about the advanced practitioner permit. Mm-hmm. Did I overhear that a person that's an advanced practitioner has to have two licenses, not just one?
Yes, through Representative McCarty, through the chair, you'd have to already have received approval for a licensure to become a dental hygienist and then have practiced for 4 years and then proceeded to seek the additional licensure to become an advanced practice dental hygienist.
OK. Okay, a follow-up with that. Is that, do we do the same thing for advanced nurse practitioners?
Representative McCarty, through the chair, an advanced practice nurse practitioner can actually go all the way through school to become a nurse practitioner without having practiced independently. And they do clinical hours as a part of their training. So you could get an undergraduate degree in biology and then go get a master's degree or a doctorate in nursing practice and then go and practice independently. And you would get your work experience as a part of your training through your clinical hours. This is different because you would have done your clinical and your didactic training to become a hygienist, and then you would have done additional training and practice to become an advanced practice dental hygienist.
Okay, let me rephrase what I was asking.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm understanding is that an advanced dental hygienist is going to have two licenses.
Mm-hmm.
One is that the dental hygienist and then an advanced dental hygienist.
Mm-hmm.
So why would they have to have two licenses? And are we doing the same thing with advanced nurse practitioners where they have to have a nursing license and an advanced nurse practitioner license?
So thank you for clarification of the question. This is designed to be sort of like a build on top of a dental hygienist permit. You wouldn't go immediately into becoming an advanced practice dental hygienist. You would first have to get your first licensure and then practice for several years and then seek the permit, whereas an advanced practice nurse can just proceed forward through their training and go directly into practice after graduating with either a master's or a doctorate degree. They're different pathways to practice. Okay. Also, a nurse practitioner has a much wider scope of practice and doesn't need to have a direct care agreement with a doctor. In the state of Alaska, a nurse practitioner practices entirely independently. This is more like a better analog would be for a physician's assistant. A physician's assistant is typically a healthcare provider that has done some healthcare practitioner work and then goes to school to become a physician's assistant and practices in partnership with a direct care agreement with a supervising physician. So an advanced practice dental hygienist is more an analog to a physician's assistant than a nurse practitioner.
Let's do another follow-up and then go to Representative Hoffman.
So following up on Representative Fields' questions, I thought on page 3, line 31, it gives the advanced dental hygienist the ability to have their own practice.
Yes, sir.
So they would not be under a dentist if that's the case. So they would not be in the scenario that you described. They would actually have their own practice and they'd have people working for them, even potentially a dental hygienist under the advanced.
Representative McCarty, through the chair, both of those things are sort of true. A physician's assistant has a direct care agreement with a physician and yet can still have an independent practice. They own the urgent, for example, there are urgent care practices in Anchorage where a physician's assistant owns the practice, operates the practice, but their licensure is done in through collaboration with a direct care supervisory agreement with a dentist. With a dental hygienist, it would be very similar. They would have a direct care agreement with a dentist, but would be able to have their own business license, practice independently, hire employees, and have their own practice.
Okay, and while we go to Representative Kaufman's questions, Ms. Holland, could you get Ledge Legal online to answer this question of independent contractor? I want to ask them why they wrote it that way. It just seems strange. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. I have three question areas, and through the chair, I think to Ms. Bryant, but I'll anybody that can answer this. With respect to performing the radiography, are there provisions in the bill for the management of the requirements for performing radiography, such as what you may have in a dental office?
I think that question would be best for Ms. Bryant or Ms. Reitz.
Hello, thank you. We are highly trained and skilled in areas of such as radiography, and if we wanted to take a device that is called like a NOMAD, which is a portable radiography unit with a digital sensor that you can carry and use with a laptop to take radiographs as needed to make those dental hygiene treatment plans and assessments, would be something that we would be capable of doing. If I may also provide some clarification, it sounds like there might be some confusion with a collaborative agreement that we currently have with the advanced practice permit that we are currently seeking. It is not, the advanced practice permit is not having us work under a dentist authorization. It is to work without having that dentist authorization. So I'm not sure there's, like, it's very similar to the collaborative agreement, almost mirrors it, except for the authorization and supervision of that area.
You can go ahead and follow up.
I guess the question is, how is the radiation safety aspect of it? So in all the locations that I've worked in where we've managed radioactive sources or x-ray tubes, there's a radiation safety management protocol that you follow. They can vary according to industry or type of radioactive source. And I guess I'm trying to understand where to look to be sure that those requirements are as consistent here as they would be if one were in a dental office, dentist office.
Yes, currently we would be using safety devices like lead aprons, thyroid collars, and practicing the training that we have under our education requirements. The NOMAD is a portable radiography unit that is very safe. They've done lots of studies on the user with that. There's no radiation reversing towards the person providing or taking the x-ray. And the person that is receiving the radiograph, due to all the advances in radiography equipment, is very limited. And again, we would be using the lead apron or thyroid collar for those.
And if I may just safety follow up, Mr. Chair. I want to apologize. There was an earlier version of this bill that had a direct care agreement. This version of the bill doesn't have a direct care agreement. The issue of radiography, all regulation associated with this is actually determined by the dental board. A dental hygienist that would be practicing under this advanced practice permit would have to continue to follow all of the rules and regulations as prescribed by the dental board.
At the next hearing, could we have a representative from the dental board and maybe the dental association? Because I had the same question as Representative Kaufman. I just want to understand, are people practicing a similar scope doing radiography right now, or are they not? Go ahead, Representative Kaufman, if you have more follow-ups.
Thanks. No, I'll defer on further questions with respect to radiography. Thank you on that. But through the chair, I would like to ask a related question. Is the liability, so in this practice, will the, not the liability insurance, but the professional liability in all respects, will it be commensurate with what dentists face? I'm not sure who would best, perhaps Ms. Bryant, you're the best to answer that.
I apologize. I don't know what the dentist has covered under their insurance plans, but professional liability would be covering our practices that we perform as dental hygienists.
Follow up? Can I follow up to that?
Sure.
Yeah. Just to clarify the scope, when we have a representative of the dental board and the dental society come forward, they at our next hearing, they weren't available for today, they can address some of the specific questions. But the scope of a dental hygienist is much narrower than is of a dentist. A dentist does oral surgery, for example, while a dental hygienist does not. And so they're going to have different scopes and sort of probably values for their liability insurance.
Go ahead, Representative Kaufman, and then we'll go to Representative Nelson when Representative Kaufman is through.
Yeah, I appreciate that their scope is different, but there's a little bit of convergence with the expanded scope. And my other question was maybe much easier to answer, and that was the reference to the underserved areas. Is the intent to limit this service to underserved populations, or is it to make it available to all in sort of a restructuring of services that are available?
So just to clarify one thing that you just said, there is actually not an expansion of their scope of practice in this bill. It would simply allow them to practice independently, but to have the same scope of practice that they currently have. What dental hygienists do will not change, and I think that's a very important distinction. This was a carefully crafted compromise between the dental hygienists and the dentists, and I think that if there were an expansion of their scope of practice, the dentist might not be supportive, whereas the dental society is, in fact, supportive. The intention of this is to increase access to dental health care for communities that are currently underserved by dental health care, and there are many communities across the state that have no dentists, and the economics just don't support it. There are also communities that live in facilities, for example, where they're not getting access to regular care because dentists, it doesn't pencil out for a dentist to go there, but it would for a dental hygienist to go there. And so the idea is that dental hygienists would be able to provide care in communities that are underserved by dentists, and that's the reason that the Dental Society is supportive of this bill and has been now for the last 3 years.
Go ahead.
I appreciate that, but I guess what I was asking with, not that it was an increase in their scope, same scope, but just moved out from under the current structure. But if, for instance, in Anchorage, where it's a pretty well-served community, could we also expect to see, businesses open up with this specific scope of work as described in this legislation?
There's nothing, through the chair, Representative Kaufman, there's nothing in this bill that prohibits that from happening as long as the dental hygienists continued to practice within the limited scope of their current training and authorization by the dental board.
Yeah, and this is a question I have. I mean, we have chain dentists in Anchorage, BTY Dental. Could BTY Dental lay off all their dentists and just have, dental hygienists do the work that currently dentists are overseeing? You know, how do we avoid unintended consequences of like that while continuing to expand service to poor kids? And that's kind of a question.
It's a good question, and I'll address it, actually. The dentists are not providing the preventative care that dental hygienists do. Typically, when you go to the dentist's office, when we go to the quote-unquote dentist's office, most of the time we only see the hygienist. I go twice a year, many of us do, and I only see my dentist once a year. I see my dentist for about 3 minutes while he does sort of an exam just to make sure everything's hunky-dory. If there's any problems, then there's a, sort of a follow-up appointment with the dentist. Most of what you do when you go to the quote-unquote dentist's office is actually seeing your hygienist when they do, they're doing the screening, your x-rays, your cleaning, those kinds of things. The vast majority of what it is that you do is actually that care is already provided by a dental hygienist. That wouldn't be changing that necessarily.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Bonholtz, I don't know if this is going to be for you or for the Department of Health and Social Services. Is there a rough estimate of how many people would fall under the categories that were described in the bill?
That's a good question. I don't have that offhand. I don't have an answer to that question offhand. What we do know is that there is a shortage of there's a shortage of health, dental health care access in correctional facilities, federally qualified health centers for low-income folks, and in many parts of rural Alaska where dental hygienists would be able to practice using this advanced practice permit now. So it would increase access to dental hygiene care in communities that are underserved currently.
I just wanted to see, and we can connect afterward, just how many people fall under that underserved category.
Ms. Menkins might actually have a better answer to that question since she works for an organization that, the professional organization that works with federally qualified health centers.
Okay. At this time, let's go to invited testimony and then we can have more questions. Oh, go ahead, Representative Nelson.
Sorry, back to that. I wanted to dive a little bit into the fiscal note, if you don't mind. I see that there's a 75% federal match for the fiscal note. For the 25% that the state will be responsible for, can you dive into that a bit?
That number is the number that is that it would be the state contribution for the increased amount of dental hygiene care that could be provided in the state of Alaska, hypothetically, if there were, if a certain percentage of dental hygienists were to become advanced practice providers.
And what's that percentage?
I don't have that number in front of me. I'm actually looking for the fiscal note while we're talking, and I can't find it in my folder.
More questions right now, Representative Nelson? Or
No,
we don't see the tab that says
okay.
Fiscal notes.
Sounds good. Let's go now to invited testimony, and we'll start with Jesse Minkins from APCA. Ms. Minkins, are you online and ready to give testimony?
I am, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jesse Minkins, and I serve as the Policy and Partnerships Manager at the Alaska Primary Care Association. I appreciate this opportunity to provide testimony in support of HB 111. The Alaska Primary Care Association supports the operations and development of Alaska's 29 federally qualified health centers, also known as community health centers, which are required to provide oral health services as a component of the comprehensive medical, dental, behavioral, pharmacy, and care coordination services they offer. Dental services and overall oral health are vital components in the whole person care that community health centers provide their patients. Many health centers offer on-site dental services provided by staff or contracted dental health professionals. Other more rural and smaller sites rely on sending patients to larger hub facilities or neighboring urban health centers for dental care. One frequently cited reason for the shortage of dental services is the lack of providers. Persistent shortages of providers at all levels and community health center dental clinics result in providers not working at their highest level of licensure, creating inefficiencies, decreased provider satisfaction, and barriers to patient care. The addition of advanced hygienists to practice would add a valuable mid-level provider type to serve with dentists, other hygienists, and dental therapists to provide comprehensive services and support integration with other health center services, including chronic disease management and behavioral health and substance use disorder services. Community health centers are ready to embrace this new provider type as they continue to grow and expand to meet the increasing need of integrated dental care in primary care settings. I urge the passage of House Bill 111. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Mingus. I have some questions. What percent? So, kids under 18. Do you know what percentage are served under Medicaid versus private insurance?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that data at the ready at this point, but I would be more than happy to follow up with that information in addition to the previous information that was requested.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, sitting here, it strikes me as a parent with young kids, you can call up any number of pediatric dentists and look at you and tomorrow. There's tons of availability, tons of supply. And here I'm hearing that a bunch of kids don't have care, and it's just kind of interesting that there seems to be both an oversupply of dentists and an undersupply of affordable care, which makes me wonder, you know, is it an issue of insurance? Is it an issue of parents with poor kids being familiar with where they can get care? Are these pediatric dentists not accepting Medicaid? I really want to understand that. And then the other question I have is, and maybe just looking at the list of testifiers, I know that APCA is not the end-all be-all for primary care, but y'all do a good job, which is why I'm asking you. So, you know, are there screenings at schools for kids who are not receiving dental care and need dental care? It just raises all kinds of questions for, you know, families who maybe aren't going to Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center right now. How do they become aware of and access those services, because that certainly seems like a legitimate goal. So thanks for getting back to us on that. And I realize that does go a little bit beyond the scope of your organization, but you seem best placed to answer it. Representative Spunholz.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you identify an interesting point, and that is that in Anchorage, there's a large number of dentists. That is not true for the entire state of Alaska. And I mentioned Anchorage Neighborhood Health because that's the home community of the majority of us here in this committee. But the truth is that Anchorage does pretty good with access to dental health care. It's sort of it's mostly in rural Alaska, and not just tribal rural Alaska, but road system rural Alaska that has a real shortage, and also for poor people and elders in those communities. And so the idea behind creating this was to be able to create more support for those communities to get access to dental health care. There, for a long time, some of you might be familiar, there was kind of a big war about dentistry a few years ago between the Dentist Society and Tribal Health, because they wanted to create a dental health aid therapist in rural Alaska. And there was a belief on the part of the dentist that dental health aid therapists might not provide adequate care. But the truth was that dentists weren't going out to rural Alaska in a routine enough manner to ensure that we had access to good routine preventative care in rural Alaska. And the creation of the Dental Health Aid Therapist Program provided really high quality preventative care for folks in tribal rural Alaska, but that doesn't meet the need of every community. There are still many communities that are underserved when it comes to this basic preventative care, and dental hygienists said, we want to step up and be a part of the solution. So urban Alaska, particularly in Anchorage, we don't have an access problem when it comes to dental health care, but we're not the rest of the state. We're just, 40% of the population.
I get that. I just don't know what percentage of kids in Anchorage right now don't have adequate dental care and why, and want to understand that. Let's go on to, I assume Lisa Bryant with the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association is here to offer some invited testimony. If so, please proceed.
Thank you, House Labor and Commerce Committee co-chairs Fawn Holtz and Fields, as well as other members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 111. My name is Lisa Bryant. I currently live in Juneau, and I'm representing the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association as legislative co-chair and myself as a practicing registered dental hygienist in Alaska. In addition to being a licensed registered dental hygienist, I am also a United States Air Force veteran, spouse of a retired Air Force veteran, and mother. My family and I have called Alaska home for the past 15 years. I have enjoyed practicing dental hygiene for 8 years and earned my Bachelor of Science degree in dental hygiene through the University of Alaska Anchorage, which is accredited by the Commission in Dental Accreditation. I am a lifelong learner, service-minded, with a drive and passion to educate and provide oral care services to all community members, as well as those who may not have the means to seek oral care on their own. I have volunteered at multiple Alaska Mission of Mercy events and Alaska Cares Dental Days at UAA, providing free dental care to those in need since 2013. As of March 8, 2021, there are approximately 679 registered dental hygienists in Alaska, to my knowledge. There are less than a handful of dental hygienists who hold a collaborative agreement. The limiting factor is believed to be the number of licensed dentists in Alaska interested in entering into a collaborative agreement with a hygienist. Collaborative agreement allows a dental hygienist with 4,000 hours of experience to work under the authorization of a licensed dentist without the dentist being on site in an area other than the usual place of practice of the licensed dentist and without the dentist diagnosis and treatment plan unless otherwise specified in the collaborative agreement. House Bill 111 will break down barriers and bridge the gap in providing access to oral health education and services to those who have limited access to care that fall under the parameters listed in the bill by authorizing dental hygienists to practice without the presence, authorization, supervision, and examination from a licensed dentist. Dental hygienists may work as independent contractors under House Bill 111. Based on feedback from dental hygienists and meetings pertaining to this bill, approximately 5% of licensed dental hygienists have expressed an interest in seeking an advanced practice permit at this time. Advanced practice for dental hygienists is not a new concept, as many states have implemented legislation for dental hygienists to provide direct patient care in varying degrees since 1995. And the legislative wave continues to roll across the nation as lawmakers, dental associations, and medical professionals recognize the benefits of utilizing competent, highly skilled, and trained dental hygienists to safely provide services while increasing access to oral care and education. Alaska dental hygienists have had a long-standing safety record with no legal cases regarding treatment issues. Dental hygienists do far more than just scrape teeth. We save lives every day through oral cancer screenings, assessing blood pressure, providing tobacco cessation information, and educating the public about the oral health and systemic connection, which helps create value in obtaining oral health, as the mouth has been said to be a window to the overall health and wellness of an individual. As such, providing routine dental care can decrease medical costs over time and limit the incidences of emergency dental care. I have seen the suffering caused by oral diseases from those who live remotely and have experienced challenges accessing dental care services. House Bill 111 will break down access barriers and bridge the gap by allowing experienced community service-minded dental hygienists like myself to be able to bring oral care and education to those who experience challenges in accessing dental services. Please do not let Alaska be known as the last frontier for passing legislation that could help increase access to care, and vote yes to pass House Bill 111 in support of bridging the gap in care by creating the Registered Dental Hygienist Advanced Practice Permit. The Alaska Dental Hygienist Association appreciates the support for House Bill 111 from the American Dental Hygienist Association, Alaska Dental Society, the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners, others who will provide testimony today, and Representative Sponholz for carrying this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Ms. Bryant. I do have a question. You mentioned the same issue with being an independent contractor. What does that mean?
So how I understand that to be is that we are practicing in as autonomy away from the dentist. He is not authorizing our work as it is authorized in the collaborative agreement. So we are creating our own dental hygiene assessment and treatment plan for that patient. If that patient is found to have some suspicious lesions, then in this advanced practice permit, there are recommendations to help send referrals to that patient to a licensed dentist for care.
Okay.
So we are, go ahead.
Thanks. While we're on the subject, I do want to turn to Sandin Fish with Ledge Legal. Mr. Fisher, why is the bill written as independent contractor right now? Doesn't that term normally have connotations with respect to, you know, labor relations, workers' comp, payment of unemployment insurance? Is this a typical term of art used in dentistry? Could you address that? I think it's Section E on line 3, or Section E on page 3.
Yes, thank you, Chair Fields. For the record, this is Sandin Fisher with Legal Services speaking, and looking at Section E, which provides that a licensed dental hygienist holding an advanced practice permit may practice as an independent contractor. The term independent contractor is a commonly used term of art in the employment context, which, as you mentioned, would have ramifications about the relationship between the party contracting for the services and the independent contractor themselves. Generally, a person contracting with the independent contractor wouldn't withhold employment taxes or things like that, and may not be required to provide, you know, obtain workers' comp insurance to cover that person or other unemployment insurance. It would be hiring basically an own independent entity to provide a service. Rather than having an employee, which the employer would have responsibilities over those areas.
Thank you for that clarification. That's definitely something that I'll want to get cleaned up in the bill. I don't support exempting people from workers' comp and UI, and I don't think that's the intent of the bill. It sounds like the intent here is to let dental hygienists practice under their own supervision, not to exempt them from farther-reaching labor relations statutes. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. And thank you, Ms. Bryant, for answering that question. Next up in invited testimony is Lori Reitz.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Sponholz and Fields and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 111. My name is Lori Reitz. I am president-elect of the Alaska Dental Hygienist Association. The Alaska Dental Hygienist Association provides professional oral hygiene care and education to all Alaskans. House Bill 111 will enable Alaskans increased access to oral hygiene care. I am proud to be an Alaskan and a dental hygienist. I've lived in Alaska for 46 years. My family, parents, and siblings moved to Alaska in 1975, and we are all still here today. I remember traveling to Alcan before it was paved. My education from grade school to college has been in Alaska. I graduated from UAA in 1997 with an associate's degree in dental hygiene. I have been practicing in Alaska as a dental hygienist for 24 years. I love being a hygienist because of the focus on education and prevention. In 2015, I decided to obtain a bachelor's degree in dental hygiene. I chose Oregon Institute of Technology. One of the requirements of all Oregon bachelor's dental hygiene programs is to provide curriculum to successfully become an expanded practice dental hygienist. Through my continued education and my degree, I learned about how expanded practice dental hygienists provide care to people in limited access populations, patients with limited mobility, all without supervision of a dentist. It made me think why Alaskan hygienists didn't have the same opportunity to provide expanded quality care as Oregon hygienists. My parents are getting older. My dad has had a knee replacement. What will happen when he cannot leave his house to get care? With an advanced practice permit, I could provide care to my dad in his household when he loses his mobility. Alaskans have can-do attitude. That is one of the reasons why we lead the nation in COVID vaccination rates. Let us use that can-do attitude to pass House Bill 111 and increase quality oral hygiene care to all Alaskans. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Next up in invited testimony is Angie Stone with the High Life Oral Health Alliance.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good afternoon, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm here today speaking in favor of HB 111. My name is Angie Stone. I'm a dental hygienist licensed in Wisconsin. I'm the founder of the High Life Oral Health Alliance and the author of the Amazon best-selling book, Dying from Dirty Teeth. I first became familiar with what is happening to our elders' dental health when my mother-in-law, Gladys, was admitted to a nursing home due to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, and the inability to take care of herself. She also had periodontal disease, which before her entry into the facility, I was managing in a dental office. With her COPD taking a toll on her ability to ambulate on her own, she was unable to get to the dental office for care. I asked the nursing facility if they had dental services available for their residents, and the answer was no. At that time, as a Wisconsin dental hygienist, I was not allowed to provide dental hygiene treatment without the involvement of a dentist, which is currently the situation in Alaska. With no dentist wanting to be involved at the facility, Gladys was left without access to necessary treatment to control her periodontal disease. Over the remainder of her life, she endured recurrent lung infections. The medical team prescribed antibiotics, which is what they knew to do. The infection would subside only to return in a short time. As a dental professional, I knew Gladys's periodontal infection was likely infecting her lungs. And due to state laws, my hands were tied. I stood by and watched. At age 65, Gladys died from COPD, or did she? It is likely that her periodontal disease was the origin of her multiple lung infections. I wonder if I had been allowed to provide periodontal services, would she have had an improved quality of life, and might she have been with us for a longer of time? My grandmother, Helen, also lived in a nursing home at the end of her life. She, too, suffered the effects of not having access to a dental hygienist. In a two-year period between the ages of 90 and 92, she lost 60% of her teeth that she had managed to keep for 90 years under the care of the medical team at the community. Imagine my guilt and heartbreak. I'm a dental hygienist. I am the professional who assists people in avoiding dental disease. Once again, due to Wisconsin laws, I was unable to assist my grandmother with her dental health at the most vulnerable time in her life. As a result, she suffered from rampant dental decay, which is completely preventable. Unfortunately, Gladys and my grandmother are not isolated cases. The Surgeon General has reported elderly nursing home residents have extensive oral disease, poor oral hygiene, and suffer the worst oral health of any population. The results of nursing home oral health surveys around the United States echo the Surgeon General's report. Some survey results have noted 42% of residents had untreated tooth decay. 31% of those screened had root tips in their mouth. This means that the portion of the tooth you see in the mouth had broken off and only the root of the tooth remained in the jawbone. 35% of nursing home residents had substantial oral debris. 22% had severe inflammation of the gum tissues, and 20% had a need for periodontal care. All of these observed conditions are things that dental hygienists are trained to prevent. I'm happy to report on March 30th, 2017, AB 146 was passed into law in Wisconsin, which allows me and my dental hygiene colleagues to provide our full scope of practice in several settings, including nursing homes, without the need to involve a dentist. This is a win for those who are being served as a result of this decision. Please strongly consider passing HB 111 to ensure vulnerable nursing home residents in Alaska can also have direct access to the services of dental hygienists and enjoy dental health for their entire lifetime. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Ms. Stone. So if this bill passed, could dental hygienists in Alaska sign up as a contractor through High Life Oral Health Alliance and provide such services? And if so, does your company bill Medicaid and private insurance, or what's kind of your business model?
So that's a great question. Right now, due to the pandemic, I have ceased at the moment my clinical services because we were shut out of all nursing homes during the pandemic. Things are beginning to open up. And so as things move forward, previously, yes, dental hygienists could contract, be independent contractors through my business. And then my business model is one that had been doing the billing for the dental hygienist. And so, and they had the support of all of my knowledge. And in the state of Wisconsin, I can be a Medicaid provider. So I am able to bill Medicaid for the Wisconsin hygienist. I don't know what the situation is in Alaska for dental hygienists being able to direct bill. But if that is, you know, if that's possible, then yes, there is situations that hygienists through not only my company, but other companies throughout the United States, they can get help and either be employees or independent contractors. And I'd like to, if I have just a second, comment on the contractor questions that have been coming up. I think that it shouldn't be only that the hygienists can only practice that contract as contractors. I would think the language would be most beneficial to the people that need to be served if the language was they can be an employee or an independent contractor. Have that option because there are several different models, and the models can be appropriate for different situations.
Okay, do other members have questions for Ms. Stone? Seeing none, let's go to Ann Lynch. Ms. Lynch, please proceed with your testimony and identify your affiliation. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-Chair Sponholz, Co-Chair Field, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on HB 111. My name is Ann Lynch, S-A-N-N-L-Y-N-C-H. I'm the Director of Advocacy and Education for the American Dental Hygienist Association. Thank you for your service to the state of Alaska. I had the privilege to serve as a Minnesota State Senator. It is truly my honor to spend some time with you today. I know firsthand the desire lawmakers have to truly improve the lives of their constituents and the communities they serve. House Bill 111 has the potential to do just that. On behalf of the over 226,000 dental hygienists across the country, ADHA supports this bill and the impact it would have on patients' access to care. ADHA advocates that state practice acts be amended so that the service of dental hygienists can be fully utilized in all settings. ADHA supports oral health care workforce models that culminate in graduation from an accredited institution, professional licensure, and direct access to patient care. ADHA defines direct access as the ability of a dental hygienist to initiate treatment based on their assessment of a patient's needs without the specific authorization of a dentist, treat the patient without the presence of a dentist, and maintain a provider-patient relationship. A little bit of history. In 1995, five states allowed direct access. Currently today, 42 states, including Alaska, have policies that allow dental hygienists to work in community-based settings to provide preventive oral health services without the presence or direct supervision of a dentist. Allowing dental hygienists to practice under an advanced practice permit will further improve upon Alaska's direct access and provide additional opportunities for safe and effective care provided by dental hygienists in order to reach patients in need. House Bill 111 furthers the impact of dental hygienists by allowing them to work to the full extent of their education and license, providing care directly to patients. I applaud Representative Sponholz for carrying this bill and this committee's work to empower these oral health professionals to practice to the fullest extent of their education. This position is supported by research demonstrating the impact dental hygienists have on access to care and public policy recommendations supporting dental hygienists providing care in direct access settings. I will now share a few with you. In December 2018, the United States Department of Health and Human Services, Treasury, and Labor, in collaboration with the United States Federal Trade Commission and the White House, made policy recommendations on state and federal policies to improve choice and competition in the healthcare markets. The report says that dental hygienists can safely and effectively provide services offered by dentists, some services offered by dentists, as well as complementary services. It goes on to recommend that states should consider changes to their scope of practice statutes to allow all healthcare providers to practice to the top of their license, utilizing their full skill set. It also recommends that states eliminate requirements for collaborative practice and supervision agreements between dentist and dental hygienist that are not justified by legitimate health and safety concerns. The National Governors Association specifically says, and I quote, "The rationale that state dental boards most commonly use for restricting dental hygienists from practicing in unsupervised settings focuses on concerns about quality and safety, even though there's no clear evidence to support such restrictions." Continuing on, the United States Federal Trade Commission previously wrote to the Georgia Board of Dentistry regarding regulation of dental hygiene supervision. And in that letter, the FTC stated, and I quote, "Sound competition policy calls for competition to be restricted only when necessary to protect the public from significant harm. Here, we are aware of no evidence of past or future harm from current practices." And finally, the Oral Health Workforce Research Center concluded in 2016, quoting, scopes of practice which allow dental hygienists to provide services to patients in public health settings without burdensome supervision or prescriptive requirements appear to increase access to education and preventive care. Simply put, House Bill 111 is good public policy. I appreciate and know the myriad of issues that come before you. I understand and I have felt the competing interest and the pressures that come with the important work that you all do. One of my fondest memories of serving in the legislature were the times that you realized that because you were there, because of your actions, you contributed to truly improving people's lives. Members, your support of this bill affords you the opportunity to make a difference in the lives of many for years to come. I thank you for your service, and I ask you to vote yes on House Bill 111. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Lynch. Seeing no questions from committee members, we are now going to proceed to public testimony. I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 111.
No.
Is there anyone online who wishes to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 111. We have an amendment deadline of Tuesday, March 30th at 3:15 p.m. I will be requesting an amendment on the independent contractor issue. We will return to this bill on Wednesday. On the schedule, up next is House Bill 151. I'm actually going to ask for the indulgence of going to House Bill 117 first, just because Representative Ortiz has been waiting for a long time, and I think of the next two bills, this is by far the shortest. So do members have any questions for Representative Ortiz while he's in the room? This is the second hearing on House Bill 117, and then we will go right back to another Sponholz Bill 151. Questions for Representative Ortiz? Representative McCarty.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I like this extension of the midwifery. I'm hearing that there's a concern and maybe to make it only a two-year extension. What are your thoughts of that?
Well, thank you. For the record, my name is Dan Ortiz. I represent District 36, Southern Southeast Alaska. And thank you, Co-Chairs Fields and Sponholz, for agreeing to have the second hearing of House Bill 117. Representative McCarty, to answer your question, I think that legislative budget and audit, Chris Curtis, spoke to what she could speak to as to why they're recommending an only a two-year extension. And I don't necessarily know the details. It sounded like it was a confidential matter as to what was the factor that caused them to recommend a two-year extension. I think that that's what their, for lack of a better word, solution to the issue. Normally these things would get a longer period of extension. And I think that the solution that Ms. Curtis brought forward was to say, well, this time around, let's do 2 years. It'll give us some time to address that issue, whatever that issue is. That was their recommended solution. I am simply offering this extension bill on behalf of the Board of Certified Midwives. And so I don't necessarily have any knowledge about why it's just a two-year recommendation rather than the normal time period. So, didn't really answer your question, but I don't think I can specifically answer the question because I just don't have the knowledge as to what transpired to cause legislative budget and audit to recommend only 2 years rather than a normal longer period.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Sponholz.
I might be able to address this. I serve on the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, have for the last 4 years, and if you look in the Sunset Audit Report that's attached as a part of the documentation on page 5, you'll see in the third paragraph, the reduced extension is due to an issue identified during the audit that may impact the board's ability to protect the public and the board's reluctance to recommend statutory changes in the public interest. The details of this are not public in order to preserve ongoing confidentiality or confidentially during an ongoing investigation. There was a concern about a peer review practice and a need to adopt regulations to keep the Board of Midwifery in line with national statutes. There was some reluctance on the part of the Board to make the changes. They are now in the process of making those changes, but our auditor felt that it was prudent to, rather than going the full 8-year sunset extension, which is what we can do legally, to instead recommend 2-year, give them a chance to make the changes that they say they're working on, and then we could have a longer extension moving forward. Thank you.
Additional questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, so I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 117. Is there anyone online who wishes to testify to this bill who did not already testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 117. Brief at ease. We can vote and Liz can walk down and sign. For Representative Snyder, we will just take action on this bill at the end of the hearing today. Just to be in person, Representative Ortiz, thank you. Next
thank
up
you.
On the agenda is House Bill. Any additional comments, I guess, Representative Ortiz?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next item up on the agenda, House Bill 151, unemployment benefits related to COVID-19. Representative Sponholz and her staff will present this bill. This is the first hearing in House Labor and Commerce. We also have invited testimony and available for questions Patsy Westcott, the Division Director for Employment and Training Services with the State Department of Labor, and Nolan Clouda, the Executive Director of the Center for Economic Development. Thank you, Representative Sponholz and Ms. Holland, and please proceed with the bill introduction.
All right, thank you. And actually, before we do this, I just want to recognize that that last bill hearing, my aide, Buckuck Barner, is a First Alaskans Institute fellow, and this is her first bill hearing ever and first bill prep, and it was a very exciting moment for her, and I was pretty excited. She's not in the room, so I couldn't give her a shout out in front of her, but want to give her a shout out here. So HB 151, thank you so much to the committee for hearing HB 151. This legislation extends provisions of HB 308 from a previous legislature that was passed last March until September 6th, 2021, in order to align our unemployment program with the American Rescue Plan Act. Essentially, it does three things. It waives the standard one-week waiting period before receiving benefits. This will allow us to leverage an additional $2.4 million in benefits for Alaskans, paid for 100% by the federal government. Two, it increases the weekly per-dependent benefit from $24 to $75 and removes the cap of 3 dependents for which applicants can receive a supplemental benefit. This is critical because some Alaskan families are large. For example, there was a family this last summer with 7 children that was reported in the news that would benefit from this provision in particular. Three, it waives the work search requirement for workers who have had to stay home to care for loved ones or as a result of the pandemic. The administration has waived work search requirements for the entire year and is still currently in practice waiving those. I propose extending these benefits at the request of the Division of Employment and Training Service, who I just want to say have done amazing work over the last year with unprecedented unemployment to implement new programs and work with antiquated software while processing a historic number of claims. And while things are getting so much better, much to all of our reliefs, we really haven't turned the corner yet. According to the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, unemployment benefit claims just this last month are still over 200% higher than they were last year at this time. Alaskans continue to suffer record levels of unemployment at no fault of their own. And one-third of unemployment insurance recipients of these benefits are families with dependents, children, and people with disabilities. And I want to be really clear about one thing. Unemployment insurance is not public assistance. It is not an entitlement program. It is an insurance benefit that Alaskans have paid into for years so that it will be there for them when they need it, and they need it now. Statewide statistics. Claims last month, as I mentioned, have increased 208% this year over last year. Average weekly claims paid last week were $440. It's important to note that the state of Alaska has the lowest wage replacement rates for unemployment benefits in the entire nation. For example, if an unemployed person earns $100,000 a year, typically can only earn $370 a week for an average annual equivalency of wage replacement of $19,610. the minimum benefit an Alaskan receive for unemployment is $56 a week, which equates to $2,912 in annual equivalent income. Last month, as I mentioned earlier, nearly one-third of unemployment insurance claims were for families with dependents. So temporarily extending the expansion of these benefits will provide certainty for Alaskans, support families with children, and ensure that no federal dollars are left on the table and support the recovery of our economy. And with that, I think that Megan Holland is available to do a sectional analysis. And then online, we also have Patsy Westcott and Lennon Weller to answer additional questions about the program.
Great. So let's proceed with the testimony, or the sectional, then proceed with the testimony, and then we'll do questions at the end. Ms. Holland.
For the record, Megan Holland, staff to bill sponsor Rep. Sponholz. Moving on to the sectional, Section 1 of the bill removes the work search requirement for workers who cannot fulfill it as a result of COVID-19. Additionally, it waives the one-week waiting period before applicants can begin receiving UI benefits. Section 2 of the bill increases the per-dependent benefit from $24 per dependent to $75 per dependent, and it also removes the cap of three dependents for which an applicant can receive a benefit. Section 3 of the bill amends uncodified law to give the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development authority to adopt regulations necessary to implement the Act. Section 4 repeals the Act in its entirety on September 6, 2021. Section 5 provides a retroactive effective date for Sections 1 through 3 of the bill for April 1, 2021, and that is the date that the provisions of House Bill 308 are set to expire, and Section 6 provides for an immediate effective date.
Thank you, Ms. Holland. At this time, let's go to Patsy Westcott with the Division of Employment and Training Services.
Well, good afternoon. There's an echo. But good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patsy Westcott. I'm the director of the Division of Employment and Training Services. As Representative Sponholz and Megan indicated, this bill would extend provisions from a bill that was passed last year, House Bill 308, related to the dependence allowance, the waiting week, and the division's ability to apply flexibility to work search provisions related to the unemployment insurance program. Other than what Representative Sponholz and Megan have already spoken to, I don't have anything to add, but I am available for any questions that the committee might have.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Westcott. Next, we'll go to Nolan Clouda and then return to the full panel for questions. Mr. Clouda, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Nolan Clouda, and I direct the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. So I was asked to give a little bit of a situation overview on employment status in Alaska and also on some of the effects of the unemployment benefits that have been disseminated since the CARES Act was passed in response to the pandemic. I think, this committee is probably pretty familiar with the employment picture in the state overall. After last March, we saw the job losses plunge in a way that we've never seen before, especially for the months of April through August. The state was down as much as 48,000 jobs, or around 15% of total employment being down during that time. That was the effect of losing jobs from the pandemic, and then also there's normally a seasonality effect in Alaska in the summertime that we just simply didn't have. So when you compare the job situation to a year prior, you see especially high job losses. So that 48,000 jobs, you compare that to 13,000 jobs that the state lost during the entire 2015 to 2018 recession, and you can see the magnitude of that being pretty bad. What's happened since then, the employment numbers look in some ways better than they have, especially when you look at the months of November, December, January, February. What happens was the total year-over-year job losses are in the ballpark of 22 to 24,000, but it's only better because of that seasonality comparison, right? We when you're comparing a summer month to a prior summer month, then you have a much bigger job loss. So we actually really haven't seen a clear sign of employment recovery in the last several months is sort of what it comes down to. And I think as this group knows, we saw the biggest job losses in areas like leisure and hospitality, food service, in personal services like beauty salons, nail shops, and also that a lot of the job losses that occurred are among folks that are a little bit younger, and also folks that are lower paid overall, and so those have been some of the important effects. Now, something worth keeping in mind when we're talking about unemployment benefits or anything that might affect them in the future is that we're likely to see elevated unemployment levels for quite some time. The projections for 2 or 3% employment growth that we might see this year, next year, and maybe following years would take 3 to 5 years to get us back just to our 2019 employment levels. And so it's really worth keeping in mind that, we're likely to see a lot more people that are unemployed for some time to come, even when a recovery is well underway, as we expect one to be in 2021. Now, to speak a little bit about the pandemic unemployment compensation, I think the committee knows that when the pandemic started, Alaska had one of the lower rates. I think as Co-Chair Sponholz mentioned, about $250 or $260 a week versus the federal rate of around $300 or the national average of around $360. So when the CARES Act added $600 per week on top of that, that lasted from the end of March until about the end of July, there was a lot of research that looked at what the effect of that extra that bonus unemployment insurance really was, and so the general consensus among the research tended to say that the bonus insurance did not increase didn't decrease employment. It didn't really actually lower the number of jobs that were out there. Some folks had expected that to happen. The more generous unemployment compensation would cause more people to stay at home, would result in a decline in overall levels of employment. And that hasn't been the case. So for example, a study by some economists at Yale, back in 2020 said that they tracked workers that had the opportunity to return to their jobs and often leave, often give up on benefits that were paying more than their jobs, and they tended to do it. They tended to go back to work when they had the option of doing it. Another study looked at the expiration of those bonus benefits that happened at the end of July of last year and was looking for any evidence that employment might have increased as a result of those benefits expiring. And there was no evidence of that at all. So there wasn't a clear sign. To add a little bit of nuance to it, another study that duplicated the same findings, that the bonus payments didn't increase unemployment or decrease employment, found that there was a slight decline in the level of search intensity of unemployed people looking for jobs, but it was a relatively small effect, and that for each job opening, there still tended to be many different or multiple applicants. So that when the pandemic hit at first, there was the number of vacancies declined about three times faster than the number of applicants. In other words, so it was really about the availability of jobs much more so than the generosity of the benefits. There's also some good information out there about what some of the impacts of the bonus UI have been. That the extra $600 a week increased spending by unemployed people by as much as 44%, which is something, and that's local spending, which means that there would have been a stimulative effect from that in the local economy. Another piece of information to add, and I'm in economic development, and so I hear a lot from people who, say that they, from business owners who say that they can't get people to come back to work because of the benefits, and I do think that may be the case in individual instances, but the data overall doesn't really bear that out. But one aspect of it that could prevent people from going to work and going off of unemployment benefits to return to a job is the effect of childcare. There's a lot of evidence of, especially women, not being able to return to the workforce because they don't have a good child care solution, and also because schools are closed in a lot of cases. And so there is a good body of research that testifies to that effect. Apparently, women who are between the ages of 25 and 44 are about three times more likely than men to be, not looking for work, you know, mainly due to child care demands. And so that's also another effect that could be contributing to some people maybe not returning to work when work presents itself. It's also, another point that really, I think, bears some emphasis is that the $600 bonus UI is long over with now, since the end of July. Since then, there was a patch that was for $300 per week after CARES expired that some states were able to implement, including Alaska. And then in December, Congress passed a bill extending $300 a month or $300 a week bonus UI. And then the recent American Rescue Plan Act just passed in a few weeks ago also extended the $300 per week all the way through September. So we're at a much lower generosity of replacement rate going on now. And so any incentive effect that might be there from the larger $600 per week amount, would certainly be diminished by that smaller bonus supplement. So in any case, I am available to answer questions if anything comes up in the course of hearing this bill. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Do members have questions for the bill sponsor, staff, Mr. Clauda, or Ms. Westcott? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I guess directly to the sponsor, as I look at line item 14, page 1, as we start to define the conditions, and I'm just wondering, that to me these seem to be a bit broad, and maybe you can give a little bit more context. So if we say that somebody can, that they're eligible if they're providing care, including medical care, mm-hmm. to one or more persons, so is that any care?
I think that question might be best to actually to go to Director Westcott.
Ms. Westcott.
Sure. So again, for the record, this is Patsy Westcott, Director of the Division of Employment and Training Services, and I apologize. Can you please repeat the question?
Thank you. Through the chair, the question is with respect to line item 14, page 1, which is parenthetically item 1, providing care, including medical care, to one or more persons. But what I'm wondering is if that's not overly broad, in that could be almost anything. That could be interpreted to literally wide open, providing care. Can you advise if that seems to be adequately defined?
So through the chair, so the federal legislation definitely defined, so an individual that is providing care to a family member that's been impacted by COVID, and so we are following all of the federal guidelines that have been issued related to that matter, and so I believe that this bill contains language in it that where it says providing it is consistent with the federal legislation, and so we are definitely operating under those federal provisions. So it's not quite as broad as perhaps you might think it is, because USDOL has definitely issued guidance to us, to all states, not just to us, but to all states, with regard to what that means, and we've been following that for the entire time since March of 2020, and we continue to follow that, and so this bill would just enable us to continue down that same path that we've been on for this last year.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair, I guess I wonder if we're essentially following the federal guidelines, if we need items 1 through 3, which items 2, preventing or limiting the spread of COVID, again, that could be very broadly interpreted. And preventing or limiting economic loss or harm, that too, I wonder if we need those. The one thing that I have seen happen, that is, as a defined set of parameters are around, the longer they're around, the more people learn what's possible within those parameters. And so this next few months may be different than the last few months' experience with respect to these defined parameters. Thank you.
Maybe Ms. Representative Sponholz and Ms. Westcott, I guess, could probably both respond to that.
Yeah, I'll take a stab at that. I think that in addition to aligning with the federal government, I think what this also does is every time we change the law in the state of Alaska, the department has to issue new regulations and also has to write new code. And there were multiple times this last year when it actually took the department many months to rewrite the software to allow for implementation of new regulations. And because of that, we wanted to align as closely as we could to the previous statute so that we would reduce the administrative burden and not potentially have eligible beneficiaries be waiting months to receive benefits. And there was an example of the per dependent change, benefit change, that took almost 6 months to change because of software challenges. And the issues of providing care, including medical care, to one person or more is incredibly relevant right now, because there are still are times when there could be a COVID outbreak in your child care arrangement, and then you wouldn't be able to work because you needed to be able to keep your child home for 2 weeks while going through sort of the quarantine process. The same thing would be true of preventing, or limiting the spread of COVID-19. So for both of those reasons, we're still sort of managing smaller fires, fortunately, because I think we're making a lot of progress with COVID. So the number of people that are filing reports, claims for unemployment is dramatically lower than it was last summer when we had, record high numbers. But for both of those reasons, it made sense to be consistent so it would be simple to implement. The current provisions that we have in law expire on April 1st. And if those lapse and we have to write new law, then the department has to, update the code and software, it could take months for implementation. And that seems sort of unnecessarily burdensome, given that this is a pretty small benefit overall. And the state's actuary says that this is not going to have a significant impact on our ability for the unemployment insurance fund to remain solvent. It just seems very practical.
And that leads to a question I have for Ms. Westcott. Ms. Westcott, should we be contemplating an end date on this bill longer than September, just given the fact that we won't be in session and wouldn't be around to respond if we needed to, or should we just peg it to what I guess is the Rescue Plan Act date?
Well, Chair Fields, I can't predict the future. And so that's a very difficult question for me to answer at this time. What I would say is that we are seeing recovery in the state of Alaska. We are seeing certain sectors of our economy opening back up. We are of course, now the vaccine is widely available for those that choose to get it. And so I foresee the picture getting better and better over the summer. But I can't predict I can't predict what's going to happen in the fall or over the winter. I appreciate the question. I really do, and I understand what you're getting at. I just don't know that I'm in the best position to answer that question.
Okay, let me just ask a follow up. So, if we were to extend that date to say, December 31, we're leaving it to the prerogative of the commissioner regarding the appropriateness of extending these benefits, right? We're not mandating their extension. We're just leaving it flexible to the administration.
Chair Fields, so if the legislative body were to extend these provisions through December, no, it wouldn't really be at the discretion of the commissioner. I mean, they would be in place through the end of December. And so some of the things to keep in mind related to that is that so the waiting week provision in particular is right now through the American Rescue Recovery Plan, the waiting week is fully federally funded for those states that have a waiting week waiver in their law. And so if we were to extend the waiting week waiver beyond what the feds have already done, then the cost of paying benefits out for that first week of a benefit year would be fully absorbed by the state's trust fund as opposed to being federally funded. In addition to that, if we were to extend the flexibility of the work search requirements beyond what the federal provisions have extended them, we could find ourselves potentially out of conformity with federal directives if the feds do not also extend them beyond September. So that would be my response to your question.
Okay, great. Thank you for explaining. Representative McCarty.
Yeah, through the chair, Ms. Buckcott, can you, two questions. One is, how many people are receiving unemployment currently? And the second question is, what do we anticipate in rise in employment in the summertime if the tourism industry were to kind of kick back in?
Okay. So through the chair, Representative McCarty, the number of individuals that are receiving unemployment insurance benefits from week to week changes. It's very fluid because some people drop off and then other people become unemployed and they come on. And so right now we are paying approximately 50,000 individuals on a week-to-week basis. As far as your other your second question, I am going to, pardon the committee, but I'm going to punt to our economist and UI actuary, Lennon Weller, to answer that question.
Good afternoon, everybody. For the record, my name is Lennon Weller. I am an economist for the research and analysis section of the Department of Labor, and I also function as the actuary for the unemployment insurance system. Would you, through the chair, would you mind just repeating that second question just to make sure I can best answer that?
Yes. What do we anticipate for employment during the summer from tourism? You know, what do we actually see or average, you know?
Just to make sure I'm understanding your question, what are we expecting to see in terms of employment levels for the summer of 2021, or what we normally would expect to see, I suppose, during say like a normal summer, which is it?
I don't know. You don't have to get the crystal ball out. Just what do we see in the average?
So summer employment obviously is, you know, certainly significantly above, you know, obviously winter employment. It tends to fluctuate quite significantly. Let me get some aggregate statistics here for you. So if we're just looking at, and you know, and we focus, of course, here with respect to UI on covered employment, which is a slightly narrower metric of employment that of course would include non-covered, that's self-employed estimates, individuals. Normally in the summer, which we would consider, second and third quarter of the year, employment this last year averaged right around 300,000. In 2019, the average is about 335,000 in employment. And if you'll spare me a moment, I can get to my current forecast for employment and give you an idea of exactly what we're expecting going forward. Second quarter of 2021, I'm expecting roughly 272,000 covered jobs, and that compares to 269.3 covered jobs in the second quarter of 2020. Third quarter of 2021, I'm looking at 287.1 million per thousand, rather, as opposed to about 283.6. So I'm expecting a slight increase in employment for this summer, probably the single largest factor being the lack of cruise ships coming to the state, since that's, you know, obviously the biggest single driver of summer employment tends to be the leisure and hospitality sector. So without cruise ships coming, it should be a much muted summer in terms of employment. Obviously, you've got some construction as well that ramps up, some seafood processing that obviously occurs as well, but the bulk of employment gains in the summer are leisure and hospitality, retail, trade, arts and entertainment, those sort of things. And so obviously I'm expecting a much more muted summer here in 2021. And does that hopefully answer your question?
Yes, and a quick follow-up on that is, do we also see that rise or continuation to normal of our fishing industry and canneries and such?
Through the chair, I'm not expecting much of a change in seafood processing. The employment actually in that sector did rather well through this last year, and so I'm not anticipating any big changes there. That probably won't be, you know, a very large driver at the aggregate level of employment and wages.
Thank you.
Mr. Weller, I have a related question. So if we were to extend the waiting week exemption to, say, October, November, on the premise that, you know, people working in leisure and hospitality may be getting laid off, or in fish processing or in construction may be getting laid off around fall, is that something that, and assuming that cost shifted from the feds to the state mid-September, is that something that the trust fund could bear for a 1 or 2 month extension beyond the period when the feds are paying for it? And if you don't know offhand, you can feel free to get back to us. I'm just wondering, you know, following the testimony of Ms. Westcott, if we should be looking at extending that to blunt the impact of people who are getting laid off at the end of the summer.
Sure. Chair Fields, or Co-Chair Fields, I haven't modeled that specific element to the extent that I'd like to answer that specifically, but I will say, though, that, waiting week being just that, wouldn't necessarily change an individual's duration. It would just kind of shift, of course, their period of eligibility, 1 week, sooner. Obviously, it's been nice to have the feds picking up the tab on that first week, but we do build into our targets for trust fund solvency and expected benefit costs, an individual to collect for the, a certain duration in their term. Most obviously don't exhaust benefits. I certainly expect fewer and fewer to exhaust going forward, but I would expect it not to have a very large impact on trust fund solvency. In probably the single largest factor being that I'm expecting regular claims, the regular benefits, to rather new demand for unemployment insurance to fall considerably as we move into the late summer and even fall of next year. We'll certainly have the seasonal filers, but compared to what we saw this last summer, we're going to get back closer to more historical or pre-COVID levels. Mm-hmm. So that should have a much muted impact on UI financing.
Thank you. Do other members have questions before we turn back to the bill sponsor? Representative Sponholz, did you want to make any closing comments?
Yeah, I just wanted to
go to the amendment deadline and so on.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about one thing. I think that one is that, as was referenced a little bit by Mr. Weller, unemployment is not going to be nearly as bad this summer as it was last summer. Last summer, we had record high claims at 67,600 at the peak in May, and those continued through mid-July. And we're not going to see that same level of unemployment. We're also not going to see the same level of employment in the summertime, because our tourism industry is going to be small, but we also import a lot of those workers. So I think that the fiscal impact of this particular measure is going to be much more muted than last summer would have been because of that. And the fiscal note on this is that this will essentially cost the state of Alaska $13 million to extend this benefit through what is still going to be a pretty tough time. And the reason I think that it's important to at least go through September is that the summertime is traditionally our high water mark for employment in the state of Alaska. That's when we've got people working in fishing, construction, and in the tourism industry. And then unemployment, employment declines and unemployment rises as you go into fall. But then that's more of a typical cycle for the state of Alaska. And that's something that the unemployment fund, insurance fund is built for, that it does this every single year. And I think it's really it's built for that, and it will survive. Mr. Weller's referenced, I think, in previous testimony that our unemployment insurance fund is well capitalized. We were lucky that it was overcapitalized before this happened. So we're in a good position. There was one other thing that I want to mention, and that is that as it relates to helping people get into work, that the Department of Labor has been really clear. They are continuing to work with unemployment filers. They're reaching out to them to ask to help to identify supports that they need to get employed, retrained, and any other supports that they need. And we've heard in the Department of Labor Finance Subcommittee meetings that this committee participated in about some of the work search and support services that the Department of Labor offers, and they're continuing to offer that even through the pandemic. This entire time they've been doing that. So the goal, obviously, is to get people into meaningful, gainful employment. But we know that we're still going to not be quite at full employment this summer. It's a time when we ordinarily are. People get caught up on their bills in the summertime. Some people are not going to be able to do that. And we want to make sure that people that have children are able to, stay caught up on their bills to the best of our ability. The Unemployment Insurance Fund is well capitalized to do that. And so this seems like a common sense measure that aligns our state statute with federal law and federal funding. So I'm hoping we can support it. Thank you.
Great. Amendment deadline for this bill is 3:15 Tuesday, March 30th. We'll return to the bill on Wednesday. Representative Sponholz, I think I'm going to have a bill, an amendment drafted on this waiting week, and we can talk about whether that's a good idea or not, just for people who may be getting laid off at the end of the summer. We're now going to return to House Bill 117. This is Representative Kaufman.
I'm just wondering, why is the amendment deadline so close? You just said it's tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the amendment deadline is close on this one because we have the expiration of some authority in April, and we're trying to move this bill quickly just to give the department certainty to update their regs to align with the American Rescue Plan Act. And Ms. Westcott, did you want to add something? Is your hand up, or is that just?
Yes, thank you. Okay. My hand is up, and I just wanted to comment on extending the waiting week provision beyond what the feds have allowed in the American Recovery Plan Act. And so I just want to make sure that the committee is clear that if the waiting week waiver is extended beyond the September mm-hmm. date, it does have an impact on extended benefits. And the impact is that, so for the first week of extended benefits, It would have to be fully funded by the state's trust fund as opposed to funded by the feds. If we were to extend the waiting week waiver beyond the federal, beyond what the feds have extended it to, which is the first week of September, unless the feds extend it beyond that. And I don't know if that will happen.
Got it. So it's hard to break out some of these individual things.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good to understand. Okay. Back to Representative Kaufman.
Thanks. I know, too, on our previous, on Bill 111, we had noted a due date of March 30th as well. And just wanted to ask why that one is on such short notice.
Yeah, I think that the main reason is that there are there's a fairly long list of administration bills and majority and minority bills that we're trying to hear and move. Just that, so if something seems to be potentially non-controversial, we want to give members an opportunity to move it. Is that a bill that you'd like a longer amendment deadline?
Well, I was wondering, you know, some of those questions about the radiation safety and some of those things may take a, you know, more than overnight to find out.
Right. Well, I suppose if there are still questions when we return to this bill on Wednesday, we can extend that, right?
Theoretically, I prefer not to.
Okay. I do want to move Representative Ortiz's bill, so let's see if we can get the questions answered by Wednesday. If there are remaining uncertainties, I have questions too, then we can revisit extending that. Okay. At this time, I want to return to House Bill 117, and Representative Sponholz, do we have a motion to move House Bill 117?
I move HB 117 Work Order 32-LS0575/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there objections? Seeing none, House Bill 117 passes from the Labor and Commerce Committee. We are going to sign the paperwork, but I'm not going to take an at ease because we also have to address the issue of appointees. On Friday, we heard from several appointees. One did not attend, so we'll hear their confirmation at a later date. Some members also had additional questions for John Cox of the ABC board, so we'll have him back before the committee to answer those questions. But in the meantime, the House Labor and Commerce Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees as listed and recommends that the names be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Bethel Belisle, Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, Rachel Pugh, Board of Midwives, Hannah St. George, Board of Midwives, Holly Andrews, Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Connie Doherty, Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Michelle McMullen, Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Kitsana Zafanafe, Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Tina Taylor, Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Valerie Kudrin, Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers, William Leon McLean, Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers, Diane Thompson, ABC Board, Dana Walukowicz, ABC Board. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against these individuals during further sessions for the purposes of confirmation. Thank you again to Leah and Melissa. Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 31st at 3:15 in this room. We will take up amendments and potential final action for House Bill 111 and House Bill 151. And we will also have an introductory hearing on Representative Thompson's Board of Public Accountancy. It is 5:15, and the House Labor and Commerce hearing is adjourned. Please remember to sign the paperwork on 117.